Good afternoon, everyone. Welcome back to the Poison Pen. We have two exciting programs for you today with two authors, in fact, who've never before done a program at the Poison Pen. The first is mega bestseller Catherine Coulter, whom we'll be talking to right now. And then at 2 o'clock, Erica Ruth Neubauer, a brand new author, is going to join me and talk about Egypt, which is why I'm dressed like sand, right? Anyway, I know, I try to sort of costume myself in a theme to make this going. But it's lovely to see you. It's been, I think, since you were one of the authors at the Arizona Women's Board Kidney Lunches the last time we met.
It's been a long time. We're going back, 10 years? Something like that?
Yeah, I think it has been. I mean, we've been working with the Kidney Board this is the 31st year of the Poison Pen. And the Kidney Board predates that and has had just a remarkable group of authors. So it was wonderful that you were one of the speakers. And sadly, they've had to cancel it for this year, as you might imagine.
Well, yeah. Yeah, they're not going to try to do it virtually?
Well, I think we might. I've been talking to them, and I think I can figure out a way to do kind of a mini version of it. But, you know, the real joy of putting on your very most glamorous togs and swanning into the hotel and, you know, Jimmy Choo shoes and Birkin handbag and the whole bit. You don't get to do that.
No, we're in sweats.
Himself, I'm dressed up.
You have to be, sweetie.
You look lovely. So we're going to talk today about this gorgeous book, which you can see right here, everybody, called Deadlock. And Catherine has very kindly signed copies of Deadlock, and they should be arriving at the store tomorrow or Tuesday. So we urge you to order a copy. And fortunately, she overnighted a copy to me. So I am prepared to talk about her 24th Savage and Sherlock FBI thriller. This all started way, way back, obviously 24 books ago. Well, the first one was The Cove, right?
What a memory. Oh, no, you just read that. That's okay. Yeah, it was back in the 90s, and it was in 96. And when I was, the way it came about was very whimsical. I was in Texas with a family reunion, and my sister, who has never done this before, sidles up to me, and she said, "Have you ever heard of a little town on the coast of Oregon called The Cove? They make the world's greatest ice cream and bad stuff happens." And I just went on point. Yes. And, you know, all I did was tell my editor, I have this book I'd really like to write. And understanding publishing, understanding them, they really didn't want to. But I just put my heels in the ground and pulled and wrote The Cove. And sent it in, and when they got it, it was not under contract, I just wrote it. And when they got it, they wanted to make it hardcover. And I said, "Are you nuts? I mean, it's okay to fail. Failure is very good because your toes do not fall off, but you don't want to fail in hardcover." And so they brought it out in paper.
Right.
And it did very, very well. So the first thing they said was, "Oh, when's the next one?" And of course, I didn't have a sister, and it was a standalone, basically. And then what happened, and I swear this is true, in the back of my head, I said, "Well, what about me?" And that was Dylan Savage. And that's how it started. A very good friend of mine, J.T. Ellison, told me that a series doesn't really begin until the fourth book. And I said, "Yeah, that's nuts." And then she's totally correct, because the second book was Sherlock's book. And then the third book was somebody else's book, really. And then the fourth book was the first one that really started the series off. That was The Edge. And so then that's what happened. And I think 5 years have passed since it started to now. Many more, this is virtual time.
Well, absolutely true. I thought it was interesting that Savage was a character in The Maze, you know, but you didn't intend it to be a series. And I agree with JT. There needs to be, stuff has to generate, you know, as you write it. Some books I think are destined to be standalones. I've had so many conversations with authors since this all started, but one of the things we have talked about is, you know, the advantages of writing a series as versus writing standalone novels or mixing it up. Because not all stories fit a series. You know, I think your structure for Savage and Sherlock probably leaves you some flexibility in the number of stories, the kinds of stories you can incorporate on it. Because most of them have like two storylines, right? It's not just one case. Yeah. So you could, in theory, you know, bring in something that, you know, is a little sideways, so to speak, and make it work. But for a lot of people writing series, if you get a really great idea, it might not necessarily fit the series characters that you have created.
So well, you know, that's happened in, I can't remember which books it was in the series, but then that could focus on those people. And then you have Savage and Sherlock interacting with them, and they're usually crappy people or crazy people. And so that's how they get to them. But you can really do whatever you want and then weave them in. I found this to be true in this particular series because you're always introducing at least two new characters to the mix. You know, as well as letting the other people's lives continue to happen, like Ruth.
Yeah, no, that's very true. And you do have, for example, in this one, we get to meet, now, tell me, it's an Italian last name. How are you pronouncing it? Are you doing it with a C or a C?
Now, who are we talking about? Pippa, Cinelli. Cinelli. Yep. I say Cinelli, not Cinelli, because that sounds kind of stupid. No, she's Cinelli.
Okay. So she's a really fascinating character, and she goes off and has her own adventures as part of this book. You know, and I like that. And then there's the super handsome guy that has appeared in another book or two, but he shows up in this one.
Griffin.
You mix people up in a really nice way, and then you can always exit them. They could leave the bureau, or they could go off and get married and have children or whatever you want without destroying the integrity of the, what is it, the criminal apprehension unit is what you've created for Savage to run.
Yeah. All things are possible in fiction, I firmly believe. But so, like in Deadlock, you know, Zoltan, I think my very favorite chapter in the whole book was the final epilogue with her. And I will not say any more because I don't want to be a spoiler alert, but that was probably my favorite, very favorite thing. You leave people with a smile. I try to, you know, so.
You did a good job. I enjoyed the seance scene, but, you know, I have to say that I did question the beverage. So I thought.
You idiot, don't drink that.
I thought she was a little slow there picking it up, but that's okay. Nevertheless.
She was, she definitely was. But that's my fault because I made her that way, you know.
Oh, I don't think it was a fault. I think that it, you know, it's necessary to make the story work. But I did like the seance scene a lot. I thought that it worked better than many other seance scenes that I have written. And I really like Pippa. Why did you decide on this little town on the Maryland shore? Because that was a fun place to go and spend some time.
I'm trying to remember. I think I was probably just talking to a relative who lives in Alexandria, but I've used Alexandria before, and I was thinking, well, you know, that's really pretty there along the coast. What does that look like? And so, of course, St. Louis is made up because if you use a real town, if you don't get everything perfect, you will hear about it. But I basically, it's very close to Mayo, M-A-Y-O, Maryland. So it was all happenstance. You know, your brain just hops from one thing to the next and all of a sudden you're in St. Louis, which doesn't really exist, but it should.
Well, it definitely exists in Deadlock. And the reason it exists is that Pippa needs to go there in order to do some investigating. And she checks into this amazing B&B. And I have to ask you, are you personally addicted to oatmeal cookies? Because if you read this book, when she checks into the B&B, it really will send you out on an oatmeal cookie trawl.
With raisins, oatmeal and raisins. Yeah, real big and soft, not crispy, but, you know, soft and chewy. Oh, yeah. I'm sorry. I don't remember when I wrote that, but it must have been around Halloween or something, you know. And yeah, there'd be cookies here.
It's like perfume. I mean, the aroma of oatmeal cookie pervades mm-hmm. this book and is like some sort of scent or perfume that several of the characters wear. So I thought you might well be an addict. They do have a wonderful smell. My husband has gone crazy, like so many people, into baking during this pandemic, totally making life hard for me because, you know, when there's this array of treats, you have to like, oh. Yesterday it was a plum tart, which is extraordinary. But his go-to thing are these amazing chocolate chip cookies with salt, you know, coarse salt on the top, and the smell, also the banana bread. The smell just runs, it's all over the house, and I'll be working in my office, and then, you know, it's like, you know, nose alert, you know, stuff comes out of the kitchen. And so your book, when Pippa arrives at the B&B, reminded me very much of me sitting in my office in this kind of perfume.
Come this way, yes. No calories.
Yes, and I did think that her diet when she gets there and goes to the Halloween party of two oatmeal cookies and vodka punch was probably not the best possible.
But it sounds good, doesn't it?
Mm. I'm not sure, but apparently she slept well and it goes on from there. But that was fun. I mean, I thought the Halloween costumes, you know, your stories have evil actors in them and bad things going on and, you know, really wicked people. But I thought that you did a lovely job offsetting that with, you know, oatmeal cookies and, you know, some kindness and some nice things. It's an interesting balance. Do you feel like your readers, you know, want to exit your books at the end more feeling good than feeling disturbed?
Oh yeah, yeah. No, we always have justice. I always make that promise. I will have justice at the end of every single book. And it's nice to have a smile when you close a book. You know, it's very nice. So I hope that happened, particularly with this one.
So there's a certain amount of alliteration in your characters. So are you addicted to S because we have Seth, and we have Sherlock, and then they have a child called Sean?
Yeah.
Right. Do you find as an author that you need to be careful about making names sounding too alike? Because that can, I mean, they don't, but you know, you don't want to have like two Jims or a John and a Joe and a Jim in a book because it gets hard for the reader to untangle all of them.
That's very, very true. What happens is if you do that accidentally, the editors will catch it and say, whoops, you don't want to do this. And so usually it rarely would be like 1.001% of time that would get through because the editors would stop it immediately.
Okay.
So and really, it's surprising how often you do that. You do it. You just naturally do it, you know.
That's so to set up this book, basically we have this young woman, the wife of a congressman, who arrives at she's lured to a seance by a woman whose background is with somebody named Zoltan, about what we learn more. And the young woman is lured there with the thought that her grandfather, whom she loved and who has died, what, a couple weeks back, has a message and has appeared to this medium while the medium was talking to other people and wants to get in touch with Rebecca. And, you know, obviously there's going to be some sort of a quest that will be set off one way or another, by Rebecca. There's got to be a reason why this is happening to her. And that's really all we need to say, but I thought it was a very intriguing setup. So do you find that getting a story started is easy? Do you usually stick with the way you start, or do you go back and revise it, or discover that the story really started in chapter 3, or what?
Well, you know, it's all of those things, because every book is different. People will say, well, it should be really easy now writing books, shouldn't it? I mean, you've got 80 something. And, you know, that's simply not the case. Like the 75th book could be much, much harder than the second book. It is, they're just all over the place. In terms of, what were we talking about? I already lost it.
I was talking about the first chapter, getting a story started.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, you frequently do all of it. You know, you just don't know. What usually happens is I'm called a what if plotter. What if a guy is in the Rockies in Colorado, and he's alone because he wants to be alone. I have no idea why, but he's alone up here at 10,000 feet. And one day he discovers a little girl raped and beaten in the forest. What if? What happens? What happens? So that was the target, and that's literally how the book started, with just that idea. And that's usually the way I write. It's just one single idea, and then it just goes. Hopefully. Sometimes it will say, you know, screw off, lady, I'm not interested. But that's very rare. Usually the what if idea, if it's strong and it's evocative, your brain's ready to go to work with it. Thank you, God. Thank you.
So you get to work with it. Do you see the ending coming, or do you write your way towards it and surprise yourself?
It's a process. You write toward it. I sometimes, since they're mysteries, the reason nobody ever gets it is because I don't know until possibly. In some of the books, I didn't know until like 50 pages to the end who did it. So you write toward it. I do. Everybody is so different. Some people, do you remember Ridley? What's his name? Well, James Ridley, the writer? Okay. He does little 3x5 note cards every scene in the book, okay? All across the wall in his office. As he writes a scene, he gets up, puts a red X through it, and goes to the next scene. I think that's probably wonderful, but I'm unable to do that. It has to be just, you know, coming. I can't do it. Which means you have to do a lot of backward buildup. You have to be rewriting all the time because your brain goes to work and no, this A and B are suck, then don't do it. And so you have to go back and blah, blah, blah. But you can't change that. That's one thing you really can't change.
Well, no, but I do think that that kind of process does demand rewriting, you know, in order to make it.
Yes.
But if you, you know, if you enjoy it, have you always been that way, or have you gained confidence that you will figure it out, having written 80-some books? Was it more nerve-wracking when you were at the very beginning to write that way?
At the very beginning, to be totally honest, I was like writing 3 books a year very easily because I was young and frisky and, you know, just had endless plots. And somebody wanted a trilogy, and I said, well, which one would you like first? I could not do this now because I smell the roses more and more every day. So it's really all over the board. You know, I look at Nora Roberts, and I love her books, the in-death books, the J.D. Robb. And I look at her writing style, and I think it's so wonderful. And there are people in writing class who say, don't you dare change point of view and have 2 points of view in a scene. Well, that's BS, you know, and oh, Nora's accused of head hopping. Well, fine, it works, who cares? So I guess the important thing in all of it is if something works, whether it's from a note card or from your medulla oblongata, it's fine if it works. You can do anything you want if it works. And too bad you can't always tell yourself if it does. You know, it takes somebody else and whatever.
I couldn't agree with you more. I think that the creative process, I mean, I've interviewed hundreds of authors, and every author has a... There may be common threads, but basically every author has his or her own creative process. I also think, and you might agree or disagree here, that there's a certain amount of superstition in it, in that if it worked once, surely it will work again. And even though every book is different, I think if you found a way to get through a whole book, you know, write it and get to the end, that creates a kind of comfort path that one tends to circle back to.
Yeah, yeah, you're right.
Just my summary. I mean, you know.
You're totally right.
Well, no, I don't know if I'm right. It's just, you know, listening and synthesizing. Readers always ask these questions at events and attending virtual events and so forth. The most common question we get is about the author's writing process. People mm-hmm. are all fascinated.
Where do you get your ideas exactly?
No, not so much, you know, that's part of it. But even more, you know, how do you go about crafting your story? Not so much the ideas, but, you know, what you know, people ask questions like, you know, how do you write? Do you write, you know, with a pen? Do you write on a computer? Mm-hmm. Do you dictate? You know, what time of day works for you? Do you have a particular schedule? Do you work every day? I mean, you know, it's all different for, you know,
yes.
for yes. each writer.
So I have a friend who writes from midnight till 4 a.m. What? But everybody's different, you know? Again, if it works, it's fine.
Yes, we have a famous writer that we work with, and my best time for communicating with her is at 1 a.m. I will almost always get an answer. If I'm really desperate, I can even phone her. It just, you know, that's her time. So I've gone over the course of my very long life, you know, from being an owl to being a morning. And part of that is my husband who has rubbed off on me and the dogs. And part of that is living in Arizona, not Chicago. Because in Chicago, you wanted to stay under the covers as long as you could because the weather was so awful, you just didn't want to get up. And in Arizona, you know, the sun comes blazing out at 5 or 6 a.m. and it's like, yay, you know, let's get up and get on with our day. So I figure if that's happened to me, it probably works for other people as well.
Indeed. You are a little warm down there, though. You really are a little warm.
Way too hot. So, no, this is the hottest July ever in Phoenix. It's been truly brutal. So in that sense, while I would love to have you here in person, it's really kinder that we're doing this in a virtual format today because you would not like it. Your J.T. Ellison books, you've done what, 6, I think now. Yes. Why did you decide to introduce a British character into the FBI? That's really fun.
Well, it was, you know, so much of our life is dictated by happenstance and just serendipity. And I was actually on a boat trip in Croatia, and I was standing at the railing, and all of a sudden, there was this guy, and his name was Nicholas Drummond. He was there. His entire family appeared, including Horn the butler. Everybody was in place. And then I said, well, what's going on here? I don't know about that much about British, you know, how they act in the metro, how it works, you know, DCI Brennan and all this kind of stuff. And so then I thought, well, wait a second. And then there was Mike Mikola Kane, who was in the FBI in the New York field office. And there she was in her setting at Federal Plaza. And then the problem came when at that point, this is in 2012, I could not really do 2 big books a year. You know, I could have done that 10 years before, but I couldn't do 2 big books a year, and they wanted the FBI, not a brand new series. So I talked it over with Mike. I said, well, what should I do? And he was very, very pleased. And the first thing I did was, I knew nothing about this, but I knew that Clive did, because Clive has many writers for hire. So I called him up and he told me exactly what he did. And he was really kind. And he said, I don't skimp like Jimmy does. And he was talking about Patterson, of course. And so I used basically his protocol. And then I said, well, who am I going to get? And my husband, we got each of us, I wanted somebody published. And that person, of course, would have to be able to write in my voice. So you're thinking, oh my God, what am I going to do? So I had 20 books. My husband had 20 books. And independently, we both picked the same author that neither of us had never read nor heard of. And that was J.T. Ellison. And so I was thinking, now what's next? What's next? Meanwhile, I'd spoken to my agent, Robert Gottlieb in New York, and said, he was so excited. He said, don't worry, Catherine, we have somebody right here in house that will suit your needs. And I'm going, oh, yeah, you know, bugger off. Turns out JT's agent I've known for years, he used to be Robert's assistant, he's at the agency. So this all just came together. It was like magic. It truly was magic. I knew nothing about this person. Nothing. She's in Nashville, and flew her to Sausalito. And she comes walking up the driveway, and it was, you know, I was ready to marry her. And we have, we email every day still. And we've worked together. We produced 6 fantastic books. She did the heavy lifting, and I did all the editing and brainstorm out the ideas and blah, blah, blah. So it's been a wonderful experience, and I closed it down after 6 books because, to me, it had run its course. Readers, thankfully, and that's so kind, keep asking about it, start it up again. But, you know, I really can't think of any more ways to try to kill them. It's tough.
I'm sure so, it is.
It's just great. And JT is doing wonderfully well in her own career.
This has been fascinating. I don't know if you know that we have been, until he sadly died in February, Clive's Home Bookstore for 30 years. And I had that very same conversation with him after he wrote The Last Odyssey. And he said to me, I can't do all the heavy lifting anymore on my own, and began the idea of having in the co-authors. But I will say that right up until he died, he was working with those authors, doing exactly what you're talking about. And the books
he were, was editing like mad. He says, you get crap in, you have to fix it. You don't send it to the publisher, you fix it.
No, he had a wonderful feel for pace, just a wonderful feel for pace. But it was such a pleasure to work with. We have all, I can't tell you how much we've all missed him. I mean, he was part of our life, you know, for so long. He was here all the time. And we do, Patrick, you know, we've all really just,
we're so lucky.
Well, we were so lucky to have him, but we've all really felt bereft since we lost him. But I do think that the very process you described, and I'm happy he shared that with you, because I think he went about it in a very intelligent way. I'm going to just check to see if we have any questions from the audience over here, from young Panther. Do we have any?
We've got Mark Graney, Kieran Dion, and Brian Panowich all watching.
Wow, you've got a whole bunch of authors watching. Do they have any questions? Hi, Karen. Hi, Brian. Hi. Sorry, Mark.
Mark, yes.
Ask Mark how his wedding plans are going.
let's see here. I have some really nice questions.
Okay, step up.
Let's see here. There's only one beverage of choice. Oh, Pat Stodge asks, what's the beverage of choice when writing?
What is your beverage of choice when writing?
Oh, I'm so boring. It's tea with 3 Splenda. Always has to have hot tea right there.
Okay.
So boring. So boring.
Well, I didn't know you could put some interesting.
Never any vodka, because I write in the morning and that would be sinful and I'd go to hell. Yeah.
All right. Another?
Let's see here. Somebody asked if you were going to pass on the reins of your series when you decide to finally retire.
Ah. So in relation to the J.T. Ellison question, if and when you decide to retire, are you going to retire Savage and Sherlock, or are you going to leave it open for someone else to take up and write them?
They will die when I die. And I'll croak over the keyboard. It's always my promise to everybody. I'm croaking over the keyboard so they will die with me.
Okay.
Not going to retire. I don't see how you can. I just can't imagine it, to be honest. You know, that's, it just, because they're all so active. And it's the reason you put your feet on the floor in the morning, you know, is to go back with them.
Another one?
So somebody was talking about collaboration, and they were just wondering how it works that the main author creates the plot.
When you were collaborating with JT, could you elaborate just a little bit more? Did you create the basic plot, or did she create the plot, or did you do it together?
Well, every collaboration is different. Let me start out by saying that. They're all totally different. The way we work is she came out here and we would spend 2 days or 3 days brainstorming ideas, everything. And given that JT was born with technology under her armpit, you know, I'd say, well, I wonder about blah, blah in England. And you go, no, oh, let me tell you about it. You know, and I'm just blown away. But we would, and what's interesting is because it was not just my book, I remember we sat down and we plotted out each chapter 1 to 95. And it was all there. Now, of course, sometimes she would have most of the idea, sometimes I would, but it was always a collaboration, and also with my assistant, Karen, who's also my right and left hand and half my brain. But the three of us would really collaborate on this and would brainstorm like mad. And then we'd be talking every day. every day. What do you think about blah, 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 blah? I said, no, well, why don't we do it this way? And let's see what works. And blah. So we were very, very close. And when everything was done, then I went over it again, and edited the crap out of it. So it was really a dual thing. The only, she is so amazing, but it's very difficult to mimic someone's dialogue, their style of dialogue. So I would usually do all the dialogue, Savage and Sherlock and Mike and Nicola, because I could see them and hear them talking, and she would see them in a different way. So that was the only thing really, but it worked amazingly well. And I'm so proud of her.
We've had her here. We did an event with her a little bit earlier. I can't remember. It was several other authors. And yes, I think she's a very impressive writer. Something else, Patrick?
Yeah, Tawny Moore asks, she was wondering why the format of the book The Edge was different from the other books in the FBI series.
The format?
Yeah.
What do you mean the format?
Primarily the third person to first person's perspective. As far as she is aware, this was the only book to be written in the first person.
It's not written in the first person. Sometimes people will be thinking and remembering in the first person, but no, it's third person.
The Edge, right? Okay.
This is both series are in third person.
Right.
What's your favorite book you've ever written and why?
Beyond Eden. It's a contemporary, and I wrote it years ago, and it's always been my very favorite. Whenever somebody has asked me for countless years, it's always that one. And it's interesting because if I say that, then a reader, if they hadn't read it, will go out and buy it and read it and say, yes, yes, yes. So we will see. If anybody hasn't read me, it's not the FBI. It's a standalone back in the 90s, and it is my favorite, Beyond Eden.
So I'm going to ask a question personal to me, which is that I observed that you are a scholar of the early 19th century. My own addiction has always been to historical fiction, and particularly, I might add, the early 19th century. I can quote entire passages of Georgia here.
I can too.
Yep, absolutely. Bravo, cried the rector, forgetting his cloth. It's one of the ones in Cotillion that I've always especially liked. So did you write, you did write some romances way back in this vast catalog of 80 some books that you have written?
Well, Georgia Heyer is my favorite author.
Oh, mine too.
And, you know, she started a genre. She started the Regency romance. Yep. And so I didn't know anything. This was before RWA or there were any writing groups. This was like back on Jonas Arc, okay? And I needed something to pass the time. But anyway, I came up with this plot. No, I'm sorry. Let me back up a second. My husband was in medical school at Columbia Presbyterian. We were in Manhattan. I was a speechwriter down on Wall Street, blah, blah, blah. But I went in, I said, I want to write a book. And I was reading 15 books a week, and I threw one across the room and said, I can do better. I thought I was great, but I understand that like 60% of authors begin that way. Anyway, I told my husband, he said, let's do it. So that was the first and last time in all these books that he and I plotted a book together. And that was The Autumn Countess, and it was a Regency, like Georgia Heyer. And I had no idea what to do with it. I didn't know anything. I knew nothing. I do nothing. And there was a guy who worked at William Morrow on the A train going down to Wall Street. And I told him, as I've been told now a million times, oh, I'm writing a book. Yes, yes, yes. Well, he kind of wanted to have drinks. So he didn't want, you know, he didn't want to kiss me off immediately. So he gave me the name of a freelance editor in Manhattan who was also a model and gorgeous. We won't talk about her. But she said, wow, let's go for it. And I didn't know that this was good, bad, or indifferent. And what she had and what she knew were the top publishers in New York of Regency romances, the top being Signet at New American Library. And Hilary Ross was the top editor. So I wrote her this dumb letter. You can now take Query 101 letter writing in college, but dear Miss Ross, I hope you like my book. You know, I like it. And anyway, so yes, I was very, very lucky. She called me at my office and offered me a 3-book contract. And that started it. I had no idea what I was doing. And she was extraordinarily helpful. So this was a wonderful beginning for me. And I know that not authors had or will have that wonderful beginning. I was very, very lucky. Because I'm sure at that time, there are three reasons why an editor will buy a book. Sheer love. But probably the main reason is all authors are late. She says, you would not believe. And so they're harassed. They have to fill slots. And that's another reason why they'll buy books. And I'm thinking I was probably in that category. But it went from there.
Maybe it was just pure talent. Well, I have not read your Regency romances, so I'm going to go on a quest to read them. And I'm a real tough critic of Regency romance now, as you already know. But I love them. I'm truly addicted to them. And we have a staff member who is also addicted to romance. And so I'm happy that he's joined us and has promoted reading romance.
It's interesting because my brain is, it's always a mystery. So there's usually mysteries in every single romance. In fact, I think there always is, just about 99%, because that's my brain works that way. But I went back through, I had the ability or the chance to rewrite all of them and turn them into, instead of 70,000 word Regency romances under Signet, into long historicals. And they turned out wonderfully. More humor, because I think humor is probably the best thing. So yeah, give one a shot. The Countess is a lot of fun. That was The Autumn Countess, but don't read that one. Read The Countess and you'll meet George.
I will wander over to the bookstore computers and order myself a copy as soon as we're done. I know people think that I'm just a criminal at heart, but the truth is I really am a romance reader and biography.
I'm just getting rave reviews about your Sherbrooke series. People are talking about it.
Ooh, they're like loving
crazy
it.
On Facebook here. So many people got introduced to your entire works based off the Sherbrooke series. Tina Edmondson asks, how does time work between the books? Do you pick up right after the last book has passed as finished, or has time actually passed?
Oh, every series is different, or every trilogy, or every quartet. I even have a quartet or two. But the Sherbrooke series has 11 books in it. And that goes everywhere, and a lot of time passes. But I could not bring myself to kill off anybody, any of the older relatives. I refused. And nor would I kill a pet. So we just didn't mention them anymore.
One way to deal with it. So before he asks another question, I have another one. Which is your favorite Georgette Hare?
Georgette Hare. The Grand Sophie is my very favorite.
Do you remember her host watching Sophie and her amazing emeralds swanning towards him? You know, such a great scene. I have to say that my absolute favorite is The Civil Contract. I think that's a good one. Boy.
And the way that it was ended was so poignant. You know, that was her first unclear but very poignant, and you hoped that it would be good. Absolutely. I like that.
And the vulgar Jonathan Challe, the one with all the money, which is the reason that Adam ends up marrying Henrietta, was a passion for oxblood Chinese porcelain. And to this day, when I go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, they have a beautiful oxblood face on display in the Chinese section. And it's my little tribute to Georgette Hare that I always go and look for Mr. Challe's oxblood Chinese vase, whatever. Seriously, I really am. All right, final question over here.
Somebody wants to know about the racing cats.
The racing
and where they came from.
Well, it's interesting about racing cats because I never expected anyone to believe it. And I cannot tell you how many requests I got. I've looked up, I've Googled, I have checked, I cannot find any racing cats. And I'd have to write back and say, I'm so sorry, but I made it up. Can you watching gas racing. But anyway, it just came to me. I was having fun. And that's one thing about the long historicals, particularly in the Sherbrooke Bride and even before, is they're fun. They are fun. And you have the mystery, and that's all. You know, I want to distract you and entertain you, and that's my job. So.
Well, you've done a magnificent job, Catherine. Thank you for sharing some time with us today. Hang on while we say goodbye to our readers. Thank you all for joining us. This has really been a wonderful discussion and exploratory, and that I've certainly learned some things, and I hope you have too. If you have time, stick around at 2 o'clock. We'll be talking to a debut author with a romantic mystery set in 1926 Egypt in the Mena House at the pyramids at Giza, where I was in December. So we're going to have a particularly relevant discussion. If you can't, enjoy the rest of your afternoon. And if you can, we'll see you in a short while. Bye. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.